Hello, everybody. G'day, humans. As we say, it's been fun and games in old Sydney town this week. The Israeli president, Yitzhak, can we call him either? Herzog is in Australia. He came to, at the invitation of the prime minister, in order to spread love and comity and goodwill and good cheer in the wake of the Bondi terrorist attacks on Australia's Jewish community. And on Monday night, there was a gathering of 7,000 Jewish mourners who had lost people or been otherwise involved in the terrorist attack in December at the International Convention Centre, the ICC, which is in Darling Harbour near downtown Sydney. And that was where he was. So he was the Israeli president leading this this mourning session. And needless to say, not everyone was happy about the head of state of Israel being in Australia, the head of state of a genocidal, xenophobic, colonial settler state being in Australia. So they organized a protest. And they were supposed to go, so they liaised with the police, and they decided that the police said, why don't you meet in Hyde Park, which is a fair way away from the Jewish mourners, and why don't you walk to Central Station, and that way it can be controlled and you're not right in the middle of the Central Business District, you know, you're sort of on the periphery. And the Palestine Action Group said, no, you're going to shunt us off to Hyde Park. And then Naval's just wandering through the night down to Central Station to bother some people who are waiting for their trains to Wagga Wagga. We want visibility. So they said they challenged the state government in the Supreme Court of the state, and they said we shouldn't be classified as a major event, which is what the government had done. The government said, in the wake of Bondi, if you want to have a big, you know, many thousands of people gathering to protest the Israeli president, obviously things could get hot, so let's call it a major event, which is normally used for things like you know, you're hosting the G20 or you've got a huge, you're doing the Olympics or something like that. So, but they said, let's do this, and that will mean that the state government and the police then have new powers, which were rushed through state parliament in the wake of the Bondi terrorist attack. And that will give us more capacity. So the powers are things like they were able to shut down parts of the CBD and the eastern suburbs, which is where Bondi is and where most of Sydney's Jews live, so that they can't go there. We're able to be more bossy about the routes that you're allowed to take. We're able to carry out searches on protesters without probable cause, which you would normally need, just within the context of the protest. And we're able to fine $5,500 anyone who disobeys a police, who doesn't comply with police directions. And I heard some people saying, hang on, isn't it always a crime to do what a cop tells you to do? Which made a little part of my soul die, because no, it's not. Of course it's not. A cop can't just tell you to do something and you have to do it. They're not your overlords. This is a democracy, damn it. Normally, you can tell a police officer to go F themselves. Not a great idea, but legally within your rights, unless they have reasonable suspicion or some other grounds on which to be detaining you. But under the major events law of 2009, in collaboration with the increased police powers in the wake of Bondi, the police were able to do so on Monday night. Now, the Palestine Action Group took them to court, and they lost just hours before the protest was scheduled to begin. The Supreme Court of New South Wales said, no, the government's right. It can be called a major event if they want to call it a major event. So the protesters nonetheless disobeyed what they'd arranged with the police, well, what the police were asking them to do, which is go to Hyde Park. Instead, they went to Town Hall, which is on the other side of the downtown area and is a much busier, obviously, part of Sydney's evening life and activity than a park would be. People tend not to just hang out and socialize in parks at night, unless they have you know, particular erotic fantasies that are pleased by such behavior. So they go to Town Hall, and we're talking 6,000 people. You know, so imagine a downtown street. We're not talking about a couple hundred people. We're talking about thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And it was mostly peaceful for most of the event. And as it began to wrap up, most of the people went home. But as always seems to be the case, there's always a minority of people who think that it's their job to save the world in a barrage of fire and fury. And some of the speakers began to incite the crowd to march through Sydney to State Parliament House. I don't know why they wanted to go to State Parliament House. I guess they object to New South Wales's raging support of the Netanyahu regime. I don't know. There's a little bit of irony in that because I don't think that the state of New South Wales has a policy on any country, let alone Israel. But nonetheless, they wanted to march from the town hall to State Parliament House. Now, for those of you who are not that familiar with Sydney's geography, in order to get there, you have to cross through the center of the city, the downtown area. They're on opposite sides of the center of the city. They're not very terribly far apart. It's probably a 15-minute walk, but it's a provocative route that goes past a lot of shopping malls and thoroughfares. And they didn't have authority to do this. And the cops were like, this has the potential to get ugly. You didn't go where you were supposed to go, and you didn't march where we gave you the right to march. Now you've come to this different place, and now you want to go through the city, and that's not going to happen. So we're going to have a police line. And if there's one thing that extremist, sort of anarchist, angry protesters love, it's a police line. And I say that only half facetiously because, of course, they do love it, because what they're all about is causing trouble, and what police are all about is subduing trouble, potentially violently, if they have the opportunity. So it suits both sides, law enforcement and also agitators, to see fisticuffs. And see fisticuffs they did. It was probably hardcore agitators associated with the Palestine Action Group who started pushing through the police lines and giving the finger to police and pushing police and ramming police. And then the police, some of the police seemed to have overreacted. They certainly used tear gas. They certainly used pepper spray. They certainly kicked people who were on the ground. They wrestled with protesters. They were holding that line. They did not want the whole city to burn. As far as they were concerned, that line was going to be intact. 27 of the protesters were arrested. 10 of them were arrested for allegedly assaulting police officers. And in the middle of all this, one little tidbit that I thought was delightful is a dozen Muslim men led by Sheikh Wessam Shakawi start kneeling down in front of the town hall in prayer. In two straight lines in front of, in the forecourt. Like, this is the main street. This is, if you think New York, this is Broadway. And they're kneeling down in front of the town hall, and they just start praying. And the cops pulled them up and stopped them praying and said, you can't pray to Muhammad in the middle of a riot, really. So let's talk about how the media is covered this, what the responses have been, and what it might tell us about how to have better uncomfortable conversations. From The Guardian. If you want to know where you're going to find a perfect articulation of mainstream progressive opinion, go to The Guardian. Shakawi, this is the sheikh who led the prayer kneeling, said police had used violence at an otherwise peaceful protest. Quote, police were so unhinged, so aggressive and so violent and had zero regard for anyone and anything in their way, even peaceful worshippers who were not in anyone's way. Shakawi said he and his fellow worshippers were about 15 minutes behind schedule to hold sunset prayer towards the end of the demonstration. Don't you hate it when your violent riot happens to coincide with your sunset orientation towards Mecca and your evening prayer? Gets me every evening while I'm out causing trouble. He said as he prayed, quote, we could obviously hear a big ruckus behind us, and I saw people being flung off on my right, flung off on my left. Dude, you're in the middle of a riot. When you're in prayer, he says, you're not allowed to break it for any reason. There's got to be a catastrophe or some type of emergency that's happening for us to do that. So how dare the state police just create, for the fun of it, an emergency when all he was doing was trying to gather 6,000 people to take over the city and march through the city in an unauthorized manner after having lost a court appeal that would give them the right to do so in a manner that would likely intimidate the 6,000 Jewish mourners who were victimized by people who shared the exact worldview of Charkhawi. New South Wales Greens MLC, MLC means member of the upper house in the state parliament, like the state senate, Abigail Boyd, said she was punched in the head and shoulder by police officers and then saw Muslim men who were on their knees praying being dragged away by police. Quote, says the Greens state senator, police then went in and grabbed those who were praying. You can't get anything more peaceful than prayer, she says. Can't you? You can't get anything more peaceful than pledging your fealty to your imaginary fire and brimstone dogmatic sky ghost who exhorts you to do all kinds of fairly extreme and divisive things on planet Earth. Maybe. People were just treated so incredibly poorly, says the Greens MLC. That is not social cohesion. This was a peaceful protest standing for people who were protesting a genocide on the other side of the world, but had made it explicit that we were inclusive of Jewish people. They were inclusive of Jewish people. Any Jewish people who wanted to go there and intimidate thousands of other Jewish mourners who were victims of the worst anti-Semitic terrorist attack in Australia's history and denounce the president of their homeland were welcome. They would have been welcome. Tell you what, amongst all those people with their kafirs and their slogans and giving the finger to police and creating a riot, walking through there with a little Jewish skull cap on, your little yarmulke and your Talmud in your hand, would have been fine. They would have been welcome. She said it right here, Abigail Boyd. We are against anti-Semitism. We're inclusive of Jewish people. It seems that she, like many people affiliated with the protest, doesn't understand anti-Semitism, doesn't understand radical Islam, and doesn't understand Sheikh Wassam Charkhawi, who was the one leading the prayer of a dozen Muslims on their knees in the middle of a riot. From ABC Online, Sheikh Charkhawi, he's a support officer at Granville Boys High School. This is in a very, very Muslim part of Sydney. And a well-established youth leader in the Muslim community. He's also a prominent figure at the helm of a Teal-style Muslim Vote, capital M, capital V, movement, aiming to unseat Labour frontbenchers like Jason Clare and Tony Burke in the next federal election. So in some of these electorates, in as districts for our American listeners, there are, you know, majority Muslim populations, and some of the most senior people in the centre-left government, the Labour government, actually come from these particular districts, which many people argue is why Labour has been so sort of adrift on the issue of anti-Semitism and on the issue of Israel, because they're really, their seats, their political livelihoods depend on placating a sometimes regressive and sometimes insular Muslim community of voters. And voting's compulsory here, so it's not like you can just take them for granted. So now there's this Muslim Votes movement, which is an insurgent movement. When they say Teal style, that's a reference to the election that got rid of Conservative Prime Minister Scott Morrison after 11 years of Conservative rule in Australia, where sort of pragmatic, business-minded centre-right people who were not as opposed to anti-corruption or to women's rights or to climate action as the Conservative government was, were able to peel off voters and target seats that were that essentially devastated the Conservative government. So there's a risk in Australia that the centre-left party and the centre-left government is vulnerable to the opposite kind of insurgency, really, where rather than more moderate people peeling off those electorates, you have more extreme Muslim voices gathering together to create a democratic Islamist uprising, I suppose, or certainly a Muslim uprising to unseat some of the Labour members. So the idea, and also the other note about this sheikh who led the prayer was that he was actually he was forced to work from home a couple of years ago for breaching the education department's social media policy and code of ethics after he posted, because he works as a support officer at a public high school, so he's subject to the social media rules of the Department of Education. He posted on Instagram comments that were supportive of those Muslim nurses who joked on a video that they don't treat their Jewish patients, they don't give them healthcare, and in fact they if a Jew walked into their hospital, then they would kill him and send him to hell. And this sheikh posted on Instagram that the comments weren't meant to be taken literally, and that got him ordered to work from home. So it's just worth being aware that, you know, when perhaps slightly uninformed but well-meaning human rightsy Greens upper house politicians come in and say this was just they were praying, is there anything more peaceful than prayer? Well, it depends on the context, doesn't it? If you're in the middle of a riot which seeks to foment antagonism towards another community in Australia, and we'll get to the point of whether it does or whether I'm mischaracterizing that unfairly, because it's absolutely true that many of the people there, as I said, just went in order to protest Israel's war crimes and then left peacefully. So certainly not saying that anyone who went there was sort of somehow a secret Jew hater. But the organizers and the people who caused the problem, and this is part of the challenge of the 21st century, isn't it, to cleave off the extremists from the people who can be won over, who actually believe in democracy. Those extremists were clearly using the act of sunset prayer as some kind of a, if not a provocation, then certainly an inappropriate challenge in the context of a riot. If you didn't want to miss sunset prayer that night, you didn't have to be there in the middle of the melee. So that's that guy. The leader of the Palestine, or the spokesman rather, of the Palestine Action Group, who just seems to be a young white dude. I don't know if he's a convert to Islam or if he's just, he just likes, you know, Palestine. He's going around saying that there's absolutely no justification for what the police did. He said, quote, Chris Minns, that's the leader of the state, we call them premiers, Americans call them governors, is seemingly trying to bring a bit of Donald Trump's America to Sydney, linking Minneapolis to this. This cannot be allowed, he says. We will not stand for it. He said, this is an attack not just on people who were trying to march. This is an attack on everyone who was just trying to have a static rally, which was completely lawful and allowed even under all these current protest restrictions at Town Hall. Yes, you're allowed to go and stand there. You're not allowed to then try to break the police line to go moving through the city. Another Greens member of parliament said that protesters tried to disperse peacefully but were met by lines of riot police. And the earlier Greens member of parliament, who I mentioned, said, we saw two or three lines of police running, chasing terrified community members as they bolted down Bathurst Street, coughing and spluttering, being sprayed by police. Not a good look for the cops. Just worth noting, they weren't supposed to be on Bathurst Street. I mean, I know it sounds a bit technocratic, but as I mentioned on my last comments in an editorial that I did about Minneapolis, successful protests are Gandhiite protests that do nonviolent civil disobedience. Less successful protest movements are guerrilla-style violent protests that try to foment unrest and clashes between the protesters and police. And if you've broken through the police line and you're sprinting in the direction, I must add, of state parliament, then you're not necessarily, you're not bringing your best. You're not bringing your A game. One of the speakers at the rally of about 7,000 people, 6,000 or 7,000 people who were gathered there on Monday night, while about an equal number of Jewish mourners were with the president of Israel, about half a mile away, was a former Australian of the Year, Australia's highest honor. Back in 2021, during Me Too, and I suppose one would say peak social justice, this young lady won Australian of the Year for her courage as an advocate for victims of sexual assault. And she was leading chants of globalize the Intifada, very fiery, very persuasive activist. And when she was criticized the following day, she posted on Instagram the following. The real story, she wrote, is that Israel stands accused by the International Criminal Court of committing genocide in Gaza. There you go. Speaking truth to power. It's not technically true. What she's thinking of is that the International Court of Justice, which is different from the International Criminal Court, ruled last January that the facts in a case that South Africa was taking against Israel, and South Africa was caught, sort of bribed and cajoled to do so by Iran, were, quote, sufficient to conclude that at least some of the rights claimed by South Africa and for which it's seeking protection are plausible. That decision has been widely misreported as being like a finding of some international court against Israel. What it was saying there's enough evidence that Palestinians have a right to think of themselves as a people who over whom Israel has a duty of care for the case to proceed. In fact, the president of the International Court of Justice, Joan Donoghue, has publicly come out and said, you are all misusing this. Just to clarify, the court has not ruled on anything. It's just said that it is plausible that genocide might have been committed and it deserves a hearing. So that may sound like a quibble, but it is just indicative. Like, I sometimes get blowback when I sort of try to, when people think that I am demeaning the intellect or the understanding of people who are very passionate about this. They think I'm being a condescending, you know, white male. And, you know, if I were to say, why are we getting our information about very, very complicated, centuries-old conflicts from a young lady who has nothing to do with this issue, leading chants of globalize the Intifada? Like, why is this the locus of our concern? Is this the most constructive way to express our worries about Israel's behavior? And is it the most conducive way that is likeliest to encourage Israel to change? You know, people take umbrage with a white, middle-class white male saying that maybe we shouldn't trust the opinions of some of these people. So I'm simply saying they actually don't know what the fuck they're talking about. I mean, she's out up there chanting. She's giving the speech to the protest. And when called out or questioned about why she's chanting globalize the Intifada, she says, the story is that Israel stands accused by the International Criminal Court, no, of committing genocide in Gaza. No. But even if it was, my points would still stand about the utility of a protest like this. I thought there was a good response. I think the only sane thing that I've read in the wake of this, because this is a both sides issue. I mean, it's true. Like, actually, I'll quote myself at the risk of being self-indulgent. I'll quote myself here because a journalist called me yesterday to ask for my opinion about this. She's writing a piece about social cohesion and in the wake of Bondi and in the wake of this tragic, violent uprising, violent melee. She sent me, I asked her to send me back something that I had said for publication, which is the conservative media and conservative politicians seem to find it no easier to discuss Israeli war crimes without demonizing critics of Israel as anti-Semites than the progressive left finds it to interrogate the disproportionate and simplistic rage directed towards the idea of the Jewish people having any sort of a state. On one side, Palestinians are terrorists and Israel is an upstanding Western democracy. And on the other side, Israel is a genocidal apartheid state and the Arab world is blameless for the plight of the Palestinian people. It goes without saying that neither of those worldviews touch the reality on the ground. When you talk to Jews and Muslims, to Arabs and Israelis who actually live there and have been wrestling in the mud and the blood of this stuff for longer than many people at the Monday protest have been alive. So, at the risk of saying that I am claiming that only one side is simplistic here. There is absolutely a simplistic, knee-jerk defense of Israel. I mean, I got into a huge amount of trouble by writing an entire piece during the Gaza war saying that it's time for Jews to stop defending Israel. In fact, I misspoke. I now regret saying it's time for Jews to abandon Israel because I think people thought that that meant that Jews should literally, that Jews in Israel should be like leaving Israel or something when I thought it was clear from the previous 1,100 words that I was saying that Jews in Australia, diaspora Jews, should stop carrying water. It was time for us to stop carrying water for Israel. So, you know, I have been a critic of both sides on this. But the best thing that I've read in the media was from the Australian Financial Review, who editorialized thusly, and I'll quote, "You have a control freak political class whose knee-jerk risk aversion instinct is to ban things they oppose, passing draconian laws." This is a reference to the state government's anti-protest laws and anti-hate speech laws. "Then," writes the editorial, "those rules are heavily enforced by police, whose appetite for authoritarianism was already shown by their role in the COVID-19 lockdowns. Attention-seeking activists try to exploit the authorities' overreach by provoking the constabulary's show of force, and their attempt to garner sympathy for their cause inevitably backfires amid a chorus of mindless chants." I think that's good. And if you're wondering, like, why you wouldn't just be supportive of the right to protest Israel, which I am supportive of anybody's right to protest anything, I just think it's most effectively done when it's done shrewdly instead of stupidly and violently, when it's done in collaboration with law enforcement, to the greatest extent possible. What is sticking in the craw of a lot of Jewish Australians is that when Australia hosted the G20, big economic forum, world leaders up the wazoo, Crown Prince Salman of Saudi Arabia, now King Salman, he was Crown Prince at the time, this is MBS's dad, the now King of Saudi Arabia, led a Saudi delegation to Australia. How large was the protest? Was there a protest? How many Muslims has the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia killed, tortured, disappeared? How many Arabs? How much mischief has he gotten up to? 18 months ago, the Chinese premier came to Australia. There was a little bit of protest, mostly from Chinese Australians. There weren't thousands and thousands and thousands of people bashing police and being pepper sprayed in the streets. How many innocent people has the Chinese premier, the Chinese Communist Party, detained, disappeared, corrupted, tortured, genocided in the case of the Uyghurs in Western China? Israel's fresh in our minds because of Gaza, it's true. But from the perspective of Jewish Australians, they don't see it as one event, the Gaza War, giving rise to this level of legitimate concern. What they see is a meme that has existed for centuries, if not millennia, which weirdly rehydrates itself when it can and spreads like wildfire, which is just a general instinct that Jews are uniquely dirty, bloodthirsty, not to be trusted, other. It's hard to understand why countries like Saudi Arabia and China don't come in for even half the enthusiastic criticism as Israel does. It's even harder to understand when the people who are visiting Australia from those countries are actually policymakers in the case of China and Saudi Arabia. I mean, I don't know if, like, all of the happy people who were giving speeches and attending the rally even know what the Israeli president does, but the Israeli president is a figurehead. He doesn't even have any control over anything. The prime minister runs Israel. I mean, I would sort of slightly understand it more if it was Netanyahu, because I think Netanyahu is a corrupt little hack who's presided over war crimes and the immiseration of the Palestinian people and the desecration of Israeli and Jewish reputations all over the world. I mean, no one has been a harsher critic of Israel's slide into quasi-authoritarian, far-right behavior over the past couple of decades, largely at the instigation of Netanyahu. But this wasn't Netanyahu. The Israeli president is like the Australian Governor General. He signs bills that the Prime Minister sends him, and he has no option to do otherwise. He's not like the French president or the United States president. Just Google it, bro. Google it. You know what I did? I did Google it, even though I already knew it, but I just wanted to see how easy it would be for the people who don't know this to find it out. So I put it in through Google and I put it through ChatGPT. The Israeli president cannot veto laws, cannot propose legislation, cannot dissolve the Knesset, cannot command the military, cannot set policy. He's here at the invitation of the Prime Minister to console a grieving nation in one of the most divisive and violent attacks that we've ever had, or certainly in living memory. And the reaction of thousands of Australians is to take to the streets and help provoke police, who are not blameless, but help provoke police into violence. For what? On the ground, on the basis of what? What happens in this is that people see that there's rubble in Gaza, and they see that there are dying babies, and they don't like that, and that's understandable. And so they chant things like globalize the intifada, not realizing that a phrase like globalize the intifada is written not by sympathetic people who are worried about Gazan babies being bombed, but by radical, reactionary, deranged, theocratic Jew haters. So from the Jewish perspective, there's this centuries-old meme that gets reactivated whenever it has the opportunity to rear its ugly head. From the Western activist's perspective, that is the non-Muslim, non-Arab, just bleeding-heart pro-Palestinian people who go to the rally, they just see rubble and a stateless people, and so they chant slogans that were written by Muslim and Arab leaders. But from the perspective of the Muslim and Arab leaders, this is why I say that the Greens members of Parliament who were saying, look, there was nothing anti-Semitic about this. There was nothing. We were inclusive of Jews. And what could be more peaceful than Muslims praying? What they're not seeing is that the perspective of the Muslim and Arab leaders who invented slogans like globalize the intifada, the Jews are pigs. And the lands of Muhammad should smother Israel by the sword. Those are the people who come up with the slogans. They don't want a peaceful two-state solution, but they provide the template for the well-meaning people to take, and then the well-meaning people get bewildered about why Jewish Australians would find it intimidating when they're just being inclusive. And what could be more peaceful than radical Muslims praying to their peaceful God who tells them to take up arms against Jews, to look under every rock and behind every tree until the last Jew is slain, which it actually says in their holy texts. This is not in any way to say that this is a problem of Muslims. It's actually not. But it is to some extent a problem of Islam, which is a set of ideas. And it's a problem of people being overly willing or overly gullible or overly uninformed, such that whenever there is an opportunity for this Jew-hating worldview to pick up some steam, they can jump on that bandwagon without even realizing the bandwagon that they're jumping on. It feels morally pure. And I say all of this in the context of my repeated antagonism towards the current Israeli government. My recognition of Israeli war crimes in Gaza, my opposition to the prosecution of that war, my opposition to the evil regime that presides in the West Bank at the moment, the dehumanizing way that Palestinians are treated there. Palestinians deserve a state, not because they're great people, not because they have a worldview that I agree with. They deserve a state because they are a people. And Israel is going to have to figure out some way of just copping the fact that that will be a hostile state. It will probably be a poor, shitty little Iranian proxy from which Hezbollah can operate. And it'll be an enormous pain in the ass. But the idea that the only reason why they don't have it is because the Jews of the world are sitting on top of Palestinian land, which is what Jews hear when you say things like from the river to the sea, is nonsense. They don't have it because Arab leaders and Arab propagandists have successfully hoodwinked the kinds of people like the people who went to the protest on Monday night into believing that the actual solution that will achieve peace in the Middle East is a single Palestinian state from the river to the sea. Which means that the Jews don't get a homeland. South Asian Muslims get a homeland, it's called Pakistan. Arab Muslims get a homeland, it's called Saudi Arabia. Japanese people get a homeland, it's called Japan. Jews got a homeland, which if you dig around archaeologically, goes back thousands of years to the kingdom of King David. But now they're not allowed to have it anymore because they weren't able to unilaterally resolve the problem of sharing the land, even though they've always believed in a two-state solution from day one. And the Arab states and the Palestinian leaders have never really been legit about any. They've never come back with a counteroffer of exactly what their two states would look like, because from the river to the sea, they need a right of return of all of the Palestinians to swamp the Jewish population at best in Israel and stop Jews from having self-determination. At worst, it means literally driving them out. I mean, they're quite open about it. It's not like, we saw on October 7th what the apotheosis of this worldview achieves, which is not to imply, again, that people who protest in favor of a more humane policy towards Palestine have anything to do with the actions of Hamas. What is to say is that if your focus is not on the war and the government, but rather is on the existence of the country, which is what's implied by globalizing the Intifada and from the river to the sea, then yes, you are giving succor to the worldview that feeds into Hamas and Hezbollah and all of the other religiously delusional nonsense that is causing so many problems. I mean, the idea that the Australian of the Year, who in 2021 was awarded the nation's highest prize because of her courage in standing up for victims of sexual assault, can with a straight face talk about globalizing the Intifada when the Intifada has been globalized? That's what happened in Bondi. Yes, Intifada technically means struggle. There is an innocent slant that you can put on it. But anyone who understands what the Second Intifada looked like in Israel, which is the most famous and obvious and successful expression of the concept of Intifada that the Palestinians have ever pulled off. It was school buses blowing up. It was cafes blowing up, cafes specifically targeting people's children, blowing up at a rate of multiple times a week for like 18 months. It was drive-by shootings with machine guns against civilians. It was things very much like the Bondi attack. So you want to globalize the Intifada? That's strange. You want to rationalize the behavior of Gazans who elected a bunch of religiously lunatic death cult jihadists who subsequently imprisoned the people of Gaza and then launched enormous sexual assaults on innocent people who were at a rave in Israel, raping them with rifle butts, massacring and slaughtering women. And you want to inject yourself into this very, very complicated situation and pontificate that you're standing up for the rights of women by arguing that the Intifada should be globalized and staying basically silent about the behavior of the jihadists who shape so much of the narrative around this particular conflict and were able to express their ultimate goals on October 7th. What does their treatment of women tell you about the underlying ideology that you're dealing with when you're dealing with the Arab nationalism and the religious lunacy that infuses the conflict between Israel and Palestine and the Arab states? Oh, I don't know. I don't know. I just thought it was a good slogan. Globalizing Intifada. We have to get out of this idea that Israel is fundamentally illegitimate and that because Israel has been so cruel and intransigent in the past couple of decades, psychologically understandable, after the Second Intifada and after being rebuffed by recalcitrant Arab leaders every time they've even tried to begin peace negotiations. And again, this is not to say that those negotiations have always been in great faith by Israel or that they've put hugely generous deals on the table. It's just to say they did put deals on the table and they never got a counter deal in return. So the way out of this has to be that we find ways of talking to each other that aren't so infused by extremism and algorithms and self-reinforcing passions. Like, we don't have a monopoly on the truth. Pro-Israel people don't have a monopoly on the truth, and anti-Israel people don't have a monopoly on the truth. When it comes to free speech, I do think it's the only way out of this. I don't think it's wise for my state, the most populous state in Australia, to be banning things like Globalize the Intifada. There are some calls for this Australian of the Year to have her honour stripped from her or to be prosecuted. I don't think that's the right way to go. Being cowardly doesn't work. Sweeping issues under the rug doesn't work. It doesn't work when you're talking about allowing people to express their concerns about Israel and Australia's policy towards Israel. It also doesn't work when you're trying to prevent people from talking about things that would be branded as racist or right-wing, like the high rate of immigration into Australia or the integration of conservative migrant communities into the liberal democratic mainstream. We're so cautious. We're so treading on eggshells so much. I mean, the sort of liberals of the 1960s through to the 2010s, the Obama liberals, the Martin Luther King liberals, the, dare I say, Christopher Hitchens liberals, were committed to ideals like that of Mandela and Gandhi. They were universal humanist ideals. They were ideals that sought not to divide us into quarreling tribes, but that valorized debate and openness and trying to understand where the other person is coming from in order to reach a greater sense of unity. And it breaks my heart that we've seen over the past decade and a half a slow motion erasure of that ethos on the left. Anytime I criticize the left, I get pushback from people saying, I can't believe that what's going on in America in Minneapolis and the Trump administration and the corruption, and you're focusing on the failings of the left. Yes, because it gave rise to all that shit. You think it's happening in a vacuum? You think the extremification of politics and of culture is happening in a vacuum? That people just wake up one morning and they're somehow convinced to become right-wing assholes? They become right-wing assholes for the large part because they're fed up with no alternative that they can see that is empathetic towards their grievances. And in the 2010s, we on the left, and I say we on the left, decided that universalism and empathy and reason and facts and not really caring about other people's feelings, but respecting them enough to not respect their stupid beliefs and to engage them in debate and to be free from bullshit, that those were not the values anymore. That the new progressive values were treading on eggshells, speaking, not avoiding microaggressions, avoiding any harm, and going after, like the clappers, anyone who dissented. Getting them banned from social media, excommunicating them from the tribe, having them banned from media organizations, shaming them into having their ties severed with their publicists and their agents. This was all going on. And what a Pandora's box it was. What an incredible own goal. Because the left have never been the good ones at cancel culture. The right is good at cancel culture. The right is good at intolerance. The right is good at militarism. The right is good at authoritarianism. So you want to open that box and start playing that game? You want to play that game and start valorizing puritanism and moral self-certainty and smugness when your adversary is the people that gave us McCarthyism and the Crusades and the religious rights moral hysteria and the anti-communist witch hunts of the 1950s in Australia? You want to start playing the game of we're not going to tolerate that kind of behavior because it doesn't stand up to our values? I mean, think about it. At some point, countries like Australia are going to have to grapple with governments that very much resemble Donald Trump's or the impending Nigel Farage government in the UK or far-right parties in Western Europe. And it is completely conceivable that when we go around banning words, banning phrases, you ban globalize the intifada today, or yesterday you ban misgendering some trans person, or arguing that, I don't know, Islamism is incompatible with democracy. You ban hate speech. Tomorrow, why isn't someone going to ban speech that undermines the unity and Christianity of Australia? Speech that supposedly promotes LGBT issues, or promotes transgender ideology, or promotes multiculturalism, or promotes gay marriage, or any of the things that you care about. The idea that we're going to solve the problems of the 21st century coherently by taking a winner-takes-all approach, trying to stamp out ideas that we regard as being divisive, instead of actually wrestling with them, is so foolhardy. You have to wrestle with them honestly. And our leaders seem adrift. Just cowardly. It's all slogans. On the specific tactic of the police, just to wrap things up here, I think law enforcement and governments have to understand the lesson that I advised protesters to take in the context of my Minneapolis editorial of last week, which is that militarization doesn't work. We need, as a culture and a society, to be anti-fragile, to be robust. And the best way to do that is to talk bluntly and openly, in a bullshit-free way, to the highest, better angels of our nature, I suppose, and the highest reason amongst us, and to pin our conversations in a shared liberal democratic norm, so that it's out of bounds, really, to just have a dozen people kneeling on the ground praying to their imaginary sky god in the middle of a riot, and then to frame that as being like, they were doing the most peaceful thing ever, just praying. No, sorry. In a liberal democracy, you deal with the facts on the ground. You're absolutely welcome to go and pray in your own private space. This is a public space. This is an environment that has been concocted to be maximally non-conducive to peace, to be maximally intimidating towards thousands of Jewish mourners who are meeting with the figurehead of the Jewish state. Stop playing games. Like, we're grown-ups. Let's get serious. We can handle it. We can handle you talking your, you know, anti-Jewish nonsense. And we can handle arguing with it. I'd rather have it out in the open. I'd rather sunlight be the best disinfectant, because what we've got at the moment is this hyper-militarized sloganeering, this kind of battle of chants. In the comments on Substack, just briefly, Dan writes, honest question, but is expressing your objection to the visit of Herzog anti-Jewish or anti-Israeli government or anti-Israel government? Well, I think expressing your objection to the visit of Herzog can be an... I don't think there's any problem with expressing your objection to the visit of Herzog. That can be an anti-Israel government. Absolutely. That's not prima facie anti-Jewish. The where Jewish Australians feel that it tips over into smelling weird and smelling like something they've seen a bazillion times before in the lore of their families, who relate stories about pogroms in Eastern Europe and the Holocaust and being driven out of here and driven out of there and refugee boats full of Jews being pushed back and not allowed to disembark in the United States because Jews are just, you know, being not allowed to join country clubs and the Australia Club, but, you know, Jews being less than. The way, where it triggers that response is when the objection to the visit of the Israeli president is much larger and much more impassioned and much more obviously visceral and much more frankly intimidating towards the safety of Jews than objecting to the visit of the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia was during the G20, or objecting to the visit 18 months ago by the Chinese Premier, both of whom are objectively much more villainous and bloodthirsty states, quite apart from the fact that they're much more bloodthirsty and villainous human beings because they actually have policy control over the, over their states, whereas Herzog doesn't. So I am absolutely 100% not engaging in that red herring that so often defenders of Israel pull out, which is that any criticism of the Israeli state is anti-Semitism or any objection to Israel's head of state coming out is anti-Jewish. It's not. I'm encouraging everybody to understand the context in which their conversations and their protests are taking place and the way that iconography lands for other people, the way that imagery of kafirs lands for people who feel that they've been violently hacked apart. They're co-religionists and often friends and colleagues have been violently hacked apart and mutilated by people who believed in the worldview that that kafir represents for many, many, many Palestinians and many Arabs. Not that they would engage in violence, but that they share a worldview that there should not be a homeland for Jewish people of any description, and certainly not in the Middle East. And as the slogan goes, from the river to the sea, by any means necessary. By any means necessary. So in December, we saw the globalization of the Intifada in one way in Bondi. And this week we saw, I suppose, another means in the by any means necessary conjunction to focus relentlessly on the demonization of this particular state and by implication necessarily this particular people above and beyond all others. I hope the participants can see it as a regrettable flare-up and think carefully about the way that we articulate our objections to foreign political leaders in the future. Until next time, take care.